The howling of wolves is both exhilarating and terrifying. If you are a city person who spends most of the time pushing paper from one side of the desk to the other, the howling of wolves can bring you an instant dose of nature at her most wild. Wow! But if you're a country person who spends most of the time eking out a living from nature, the howling of wolves can terrify you. Oh my God, what was that? Having heard this howling of the wolves, we pause to ask, can wolves just get along with the rest of us?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 609th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Vancouver who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hi.
Producer Carol Stafford.
Hello.
Parmalee Taft.
Hello.
Folks, the howling of wolves is both exhilarating and terrifying. My wife Marlene and I experienced both sides of this emotional equation during a recent stay at a horse ranch up in Montana's Paradise Valley. Towards sundown, we went out to glass the nearby mountain slopes in the hopes of spotting a pack of wolves that reportedly lived up a draw. All along the base of this mountain front, Black Angus cattle grazed peacefully on green pastures. All was sunset quiet. Just when we were about to give up our quest and head back to the ranch for a glass of Cabernet, we heard it. The howling. This howling was a clear announcement to the Paradise Valley, and the intent of the announcers was unmistakable. I immediately thought of Jack Nicholson in The Shining. We're back! Adrenaline poured into our afterburners, and we thrilled at this wildness of that howling. But we were not the only ones to have heard it. Up and down the mountain's front, black cattle were mooing in panic and running about in their fenced pastures, not knowing what to do or which way to go. Later, our rancher friend held up a prize wolf pelt for us to examine. Were you a six-footer, the wolf would have stood up to your belt buckle, and it was fully 7'2" from head to tail. He then told a story about how his neighbor returned home late one night to find a naked wolf standing in his driveway. This wolf had apparently lost all of its hair due to some kind of disease, and so looked, in the headlights of the car at least, like a white, man-like, muscular monster crouching on all fours and snarling at the intrusion. As city people in need of the wild, we do thrill at the howling of wolves. As country people in need of the civil, we are terrified at that howling. We have hunted wolves to extinction and successfully reintroduced them as endangered species. We have delisted them from the endangered species list and then, at the judge's insistence, relisted them again. We love wolves. We hate wolves. And today we pause to ask, can't we just get along with the wolves? Here to help us hunt for an answer, we have Jay Bodner, who is a natural resources director for the Montana Stock Growers Association. Jay, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you a little bit about wolves. It certainly, I think you framed the question certainly right, that there are both sides of the story when it comes to wolves, folks that love them, folks that hate them, and really folks that are just impacted by them, and that's really what the livestock producer is.
Mm-hmm. First, tell us a little bit about the Montana Stock Growers Association. Who are you folks?
Montana Stock Growers Association is a livestock industry. We're a membership organization. We were started in Montana in 1884, basically before our state was even Montana. And it was put together basically by a number of real influential producers back in the early days who decided that we needed to organize to protect our industry. And it certainly has gone through a lot of the issues through the years, but it was basically that was the foundation, and we're still going strong.
Still going strong. We always ask who pays the way.
But paid by strictly livestock producers. We don't have, any government help, or it's producers that are wanting to basically address some of the issues, and they need help either at the state or national level, and that's why they become members of our organization.
Well, good. Do you have a favorite wolf story?
Well, I think one of the misconceptions a little bit is I'm also a producer and have a ranch. We actually...
Where at, Jay?
We're actually in central Montana around Lewistown.
Okay,
and,
good.
And right about in the center of the state. And our ranch has actually not had an actual wolf kill. We've had... they're near us, but we haven't had any kills yet. We've dealt with bears.
When you say kills, what does that mean? You're...
Actual wolves that come in and depredate on livestock.
Okay, so you haven't lost any livestock to wolves yet.
To wolves, right. Mm-hmm. That's correct. But I think one of the misconceptions that we think about as wolves is when people tend to think about wolves, they kind of think of the wilderness, the backcountry, and actually I think one of the biggest things that wolves do is they're not really limited by habitat, they're limited by prey. So mm-hmm. where there's prey, there's where wolves are, and tend to be in private life. Private land is very rich in wildlife, and then the wolves tend to migrate where the prey are.
Right.
And we have some instances where people have brought in cattle, sheep, right next to the house in order to protect them. And we had one instance where it was a five-wire hot wire fence where they had some young cattle in there, and because they had some losses to wolves, and so they brought them in close, hoping then to protect those livestock, and woke up the next morning, and the wolves had gotten through this pen, hot, electrified pen, killed two calves, injured another one, and then had left. And it was really, that producer at that point had really no other option. He had done everything he possibly could, and yet still suffered some losses.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about wolves going after, you know, going where the prey is. I live here in the city, and there's a green belt not too far away, but my daughter was out in a schoolyard right across the street, and there was in the evening walking her dog, and there was a mountain lion in the schoolyard. So maybe, who knows what the mountain lion was after in the schoolyard, but what the heck. Also with us today, we have Suzanne Stone, who's with Defenders of the Wildlife. Suzanne, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, love to have you aboard. Who is Defenders of the Wildlife? Defenders of Wildlife?
Defenders is a national wildlife conservation organization, and it's dedicated to the protection of all native animals and plants in their mm-hmm. natural communities. We have about 1 million members across the West and throughout the nation, and I think we have become well known as an advocate for innovative solutions to safeguard our wildlife heritage in this country for generations to come.
Good. And who pays your way, at Defenders of the Wildlife?
Well, like Jay, we're not funded by the government. We're funded by private donations of wildlife conservation supporters around the country.
Fair enough. Do you have a good wolf story for us, Suzanne? Well, you worked, incidentally, I read a little bit of your bio, and you've been working on the wolves and the wolf reintroduction for a long time.
Right. Came on board in the 1980s, and then was a member of the Yellowstone, Idaho, U.S.-Canadian wolf reintroduction team. So mm-hmm. I was up in Canada helping to bring wolves back to Idaho and Yellowstone National Park, I've been working on wolves ever since then.
So you probably have lots of good wolf stories.
It's hard choosing any that are a favorite, but because uh-huh. There's so many. But, you know, I think one that's just poignant, when I first started in the 1980s, there were no known wolves left here in Idaho. We had had thousands of wolves here historically, but they had been poisoned and shot prior to 1930s. And as the wolf population in Canada started to grow, and as we gained the Endangered Species Act and its protection for wolves and their species in the country in the 1970s, wolves started making it back across the border and started repopulating Idaho and Montana. They were successful in Montana, but not so in Idaho. And the wolves that we did find here had been poisoned illegally or had been killed otherwise. Shoot shovel shut up is a common...
What did you say again?
It's called shoot, shovel, and shut up.
Okay, good. Shoot them, shovel them into the ground, and shut up about
right.
it. Okay.
Kind of a rural attitude towards mm-hmm. wolves at the time. And So when I came on board, I was an intern for the Central Idaho Wolf Recovery Steering Committee, which had many agencies involved, including the Nez Perce tribe. And I was investigating wolf sightings in our state. And unfortunately, most of them led to animals that were dead. But on one occasion in the early 1990s, we had a pack of wolves to answer, and it was dusk. It was up in the Frank Church River No Return Wilderness Area, deep in the wilderness. The lowest, it's the largest wilderness area in the lower 48 states.
And you heard the howling?
And I was howling, trying to get them to respond, because that's a common way for us to look for wolves. And didn't have any response at all. So I went to set up my camp, was making my campfire, and suddenly the woods were just filled with this chorus of wolves. And they were howling exactly back to the spot where I had been standing about a half hour earlier. So I stood up and turned my tape recorder on, and kind of through the tears just started howling back to them. And we howled back and forth with each other for about, it seemed a long time.
Okay, there's a great story, folks. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson right back. Do stay tuned. Thanks, Suzanne. Hold on.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, we shot them into extinction, hunted them into extinction. We reintroduced them as an endangered species. We listed them. We were successful in this reintroduction. And so we took them off the endangered species list, and then we put them right back on again. It's the wolves we're talking about, of course. And we're talking about trying to figure out whether we can indeed get along with wolves or whether it's just an impossibility. We have Jay Bodner with us, who is with the Montana Stock Growers Association, and Suzanne Stone, who's with the Defenders of the Wildlife. I've been following this story for many years, it seems like, and the first time I did it, I did a live broadcast from the kitchen table of a sheep rancher near Fishtail, Montana, which is right in the lee of the Beartooth Mountains and due east of Yellowstone Park. He was being plagued by a pack of wolves who were feeding on his sheep. And so we were sitting there at the kitchen table, and he was kind of wondering, you know, what to do. He did not really know what to do, and he was being reimbursed for his sheep, perhaps even by the Defenders of the Wildlife. I know Suzanne has been working on that kind of program for a long time. But right in the middle of our program, into the kitchen walk the fish and game biologist responsible for the reintroduction, and he had a tracking antenna in his hand, and he said, "She's back," referring, of course, to the alpha female of the pack who was back raiding his sheep, the sheep rancher sheep. And so I asked this biologist why we are reintroducing wolves back into the West. And I asked whether it was to control the population of cervids, the deer and elk and whatnot. And he said, no, the real reason we're bringing wolves back into the environment is for the city people. It's the city people who want them. Suzanne, does that make any sense?
Oh, it wouldn't. Absolutely not. I think it doesn't represent why we brought wolves back to this country.
Why did we bring them?
We brought them back the same reason we have brought back bald eagles, the same reason that we have tried to restore our black-footed ferret populations, our grizzly bear. Wolves are a native species to this part of the country, and they're a very important part of our ecological structure here for our wildlife populations here in the West. So absolutely, there's no other reason to have brought them back other than
To keep things in balance. Is that what you're saying?
Well, exactly. For the same reasons that we bring back other species, these species were once native to our our landscape here, and they're very important to our ecological functioning here in the region. When you lose these top carnivores, you really see a loss of biodiversity all the way down the food chain from them. And so protecting animals like wolves and grizzly and bald eagles and other top carnivores is really important for our native ecosystems and how they function here.
How do having these apex predators in the environment increase the biodiversity?
Well, you know, there's a short answer which I'll give you, and I'll also suggest that there's some really good reading material out there as well. There's a new book called Where the Wild Things Were that's by William Stoltenberg that really talks about in depth a number of different studies around the world of where we have top carnivores that are destroyed their populations, and then we see all the way down the food chain how that affects other species. So with wolves, they are very important to the ecological niche that they fill by helping to cull our wildlife ungulate herds here, so elk and deer populations. And so these animals, the wolves, very much tend to prey on the weakest animals, the ones that are diseased, the ones that are very old. We saw in the Yellowstone wolf population that they were taking very aged animals from elk and deer populations, and that makes sense. They're the most vulnerable. But one thing I'd like to just jump in and say is that I believe I know which ranch you were talking about over in Fishtail, and we have helped that particular rancher, not only for compensation, you were right about that, but we also helped construct an electric fence over there to go around as a night corral for his sheep.
Oh.
And since he's had that corral up and running for the last few years, he's lost one sheep to wolves. And it's been just a really remarkable success.
That's a good story, then.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one sheep was because it didn't get put in the pen at night one night, and we still had wolves in the area, and they did find that sheep. But, you know, I think that these preventative strategies, that we can manage conflicts between wolves and livestock through solutions like that, that really benefit both people and wolves.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's go to the cattle side of the issue. Jay Bodner, why on earth did we reintroduce wolves into the American West? From a cattleman's perspective, what were we trying to do?
Well, actually, I think from a cattle perspective, the reintroduction was really met with pretty hard feelings and a fair amount of resistance. And I think just for the sheer fact of that, we knew that we were going to be impacted by the wolf reintroduction. I think by the reintroductions when they came into Yellowstone in a couple different years, those numbers quickly raised to increase the population and the wolf population generally faster than I think anybody really expected. And I think from the livestock industry, there was a natural progression of wolves that were traveling from Canada down in through northwest Montana and probably working their way down farther than that. And I think that approach of a natural recolonization or natural recovery of those wolves as they drift down and kind of basically learn the terrain a little bit would have been much more appropriate from the livestock standpoint of a recovery type of operation, where you're slowly introducing instead of just all of a sudden drop a population of wolves in Yellowstone that really have, you know, new terrain, new territory. They have to find their way, basically. And then you see a lot of livestock producers that have never dealt with wolves basically in their lifespan because their grandfathers may have, but they haven't. And livestock were not ready for that, both on the sheep and cattle side of things. And so that just reintroduction certainly was just basically like dropping a bomb in the livestock industry. We just, it was just almost unbearable for some producers to take.
Now, they dropped the wolf bomb, as you say it, into Yellowstone Park, but the wolves just didn't stay there, did they? You're out there in central Montana, which is Lewistown's a couple hundred miles, maybe, from the wolf reintroduction, and you see how wolves out there as well now?
Well, actually, I don't think there's any confirmed, necessarily, but what confirmed from a a state or government standpoint and confirmed from livestock producers are probably two different things in a lot of instances, which, you know, there's a lot of producers that are out there on the land every day. They see these things and, you know, what potentially probably is a wolf because they can travel long distances. I don't think anybody would dispute that. And they're certainly, their population is increasing. They're looking for new territory. So I would not be surprised that they're out here in this country. Actually, just not too far from our ranch, there are, I don't know that it's actually confirmed yet, but most likely wolves that are in this area too. So I would expect wolves to travel long distances. I mean, there's certainly some parts of Montana where it gets flatter and they would be a little easier to detect, but in a lot of times in Montana, these wolves are not, they're smart animals. There's no doubt about it.
They're magnificent animals. I can't believe how incredibly magnificent they are. The pelt that I saw was 7'2" from head to tail. My goodness, that's a huge animal.
It seems like it, doesn't it? Yeah, the wolves that we brought back in from Canada, I think weighed, the females typically about 90 pounds or so. The males were up to about 135 pounds, and it does look pretty magnificent when they have their winter coats on.
Yeah.
One thing that I want to point out when Jay's talking about the bomb being dropped, you know, we brought 35 wolves back to Idaho and 31 wolves to Yellowstone National Park. And from that, the population grew. But the reason that we had to bring them back is, you know, to finish this, a little bit more of the story that I told you earlier about hearing the wolves howling. Those wolves.
Well, let's go back to that. We have to take a quick break, Suzanne. But let's go back to your story when we get back from this break, because it's a great story anyway.
<That's a deal.
laughs> Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about the howling of wolves. And you're invited to participate if you have questions and comments about wolves, about reintroducing wolves into the food chain. Pick up your phone and join us. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. Join us. We'd love to hear from you. Well, the howling of wolves is both exhilarating and terrifying. If you're a city person who spends most of your life pushing paper from one side of the desk to the other, you know, hearing those wolves can be incredibly exhilarating. But if you're a country person who's been trying to eke out a living from nature, it can also be terrifying. Having heard this howling of the wolves very recently, we paused to ask, can wolves and us just get along? And we're asking Jay Bodner, who is the Natural Resources Director for the Montana Stock Growers Association, and Suzanne Stone, Defenders of Wildlife. Suzanne, you're going to finish your story about this wonderful story about calling the wolves, but first you have to call the wolves for us.
Uh-oh. Okay. I don't know if I can do that without blowing your eardrum.
Well, you just step back from the phone a little bit.
Okay. All right. So we do this in order to look for wolves in the backcountry. It's one of the best ways for us to be able to monitor wolves that aren't radio collared. So all right, here we go. Okay, that's about as low as I can go.
Wow. That's real mournful.
They do have an incredibly, you know, heart-touching cry, so it's amazing. But
you know, when I heard them recently up in the Paradise Valley, it really was more of an announcement to the valley that, hey, we're coming out and you better watch out. I mean, it had that Jack Nicholson tone to it, you know, in The Shining when he says, he's back! That's what the wolves, I was really amazed to see its impact on the cattle.
Yeah, I'm surprised by that too, because we've certainly seen wolves even walk through cattle herds before without the cows even so much as lifting their heads. So, you know, sometimes when wolves have that defiant type howl going on, they're typically talking to another wolf pack.
Another wolf pack,
because they're very territorial and they're trying to defend their territory.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that Jay had brought up a little earlier, I think it's really important that, you know, we would love to have seen wolves come back on their own, and we certainly supported them coming back to Montana on their own, but they didn't make it to Yellowstone, and they couldn't make it to Central Idaho and survive. Even the wolves the wolves that I was howling with is a good example. This was years before the reintroduction of wolves, and that pack that I howled with, we found poisoned just within a few days after that experience that I had with them. So there was just you know, really difficult to be able to jumpstart this program. And the scientists at the time said, you know, this, the only way we're going to make it in rebuilding this population is by getting wolves established in three core areas. And that was Yellowstone National Park, Central Idaho in the Frank Church River No Return Wilderness Area, and in northwestern Montana. Now, we've always known that wolves would never stay in just those areas, that they would, the whole point of it was that they would be connected with each other between those three different areas, and that that connection would occur mostly on the national forest. And that's where we have most of our conflicts, is on the national forest. It's not necessarily on private land, it's on public land. And, you know, I think, you know, I've worked with...
Then, since you raised that, is this a fight over the public lands?
I hope not. You know, I worked with Jay for a number of years now, too, and I think that we have seen both the ranching and the conservation community really start making the turn toward trying to resolve these conflicts and work together. I think both can coexist. I mean, you know, last year alone, we had coyotes in our region kill 26,000 head of livestock, and wolves were responsible for less than 400 that we know of.
So the solution then is to talk wolves into eating coyotes.
Well, you know what? Wolves do, they are pretty tough on coyotes.
They are,
funny
yeah.
you mentioned that, because we've already had our Wildlife Services Director, Mark Collins, has told us that the evidence is building, that the presence of wolves is actually resulting in fewer coyotes. And wouldn't it be ironic if down the road we found out that livestock losses overall are less because of having wolves back on the landscape?
Well, Jay Bodner, how on earth do cattlemen get along with wolves? Or do
I guess that varies really across the landscape, Michael. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are certainly areas in Montana where there are, I would consider, hot spots where wolves chronically were going to depredate on cattle. There are other spots in Montana where typically you don't see a tremendous amount of interaction between wolves and livestock.
So what is the difference between those two territories, and why do wolves depredate in one place and not in another?
You know, I think it varies also. I think it varies by terrain. Typically, if there are real steep terrain and then low valleys, a lot of times those elk will migrate out of the mountains, or deer. They would go down into the lowlands. Of course, then those wolves are going to travel and follow those animals along. And then right in the bottoms is typically in those lowlands is where the livestock occurs. So typically, they'll follow them down, and if they see an animal that they're opportunistic, there's no doubt about it, and certainly a cow or a calf is going to be a lot easier to depredate on than an elk or a deer, and then there's just areas like that. It could be just where the game is at, the terrain. And there's just spots where wolves like, and spots where typically they don't travel as much. So it really varies across the landscape of kind of where they travel.
You know, while up in Montana, I stopped by my grandparents' farm near the little town of Belfry, Montana, and which is just in the lee of Yellowstone Park, right down the Clark's Fork of the Yellowstone River Valley. And the resident farmer was there, and I got to talking with him, and I asked him about wolves and whatnot. And he said, oh, yeah, they've just been through here. He said, what happened is that evidently wolves chased the elk out of the park or out of the mountains, and he knew that because the elk came through his farm and trampled all of his crops and knocked down his fence and raised all kinds of havoc in the fields, you know. So then the wolves came and chased to follow the elk, and so they both moved on, and now he has no elk and no wolves. Is that the way it's working?
Well, you know, I think that there's some real truth to that. We have seen, I guess, just from a number of producers that I have talked with, had said, and it varies in different areas of the state, but the wolves have actually changed a lot of the patterns of the elk. And typically in the Madison Valley, I would use for instance, typically those elk would come down in the winter where it's a little bit lower snow levels, a little bit easier for grazing opportunities for them, and then typically as the spring starts to break up, those elk would migrate back up into the mountains. And with the wolves in those areas, at least they are continuing to concentrate those elk a little bit more in higher numbers, and then also at lower levels. So typically, where you're going to see elk in the bottom, you're starting to see more elk year round versus when those elk would just basically move out and migrate and then just kind of disperse along the landscape. So there are areas certainly where wolves have changed the patterns of these animals.
Mm-hmm. Now, Suzanne talked a lot about the idea was to plant wolves in three areas and then to have those wolves intermingle via the national forest corridors that I guess kind of connect these areas. And so the conflict, as was pointed out, appears to be developing over the use of this federally owned land and whether it should be available to wolves or available to cattlemen or both. So when we get back, I'd like to ask you how we're going to resolve this. And as I understand it, it's already been adjudicated in a federal court. So we'll talk about that as well. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about wolves, the howling of wolves. And we've got two great wolf people talking about it. We have Suzanne Stone with Defenders of Wildlife, calling in from Boise, Montana, and Jay Bodner with the Montana Stock Growers Association in Bozeman, Montana, Boise, Idaho. So we got the bees. And you, pick up your phones and join us today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Do stay tuned. Well, can't we just all get along here? We being you and I and ranchers throughout the American West. And them being the wolves, can we get along together? Can wolves exist where people exist? And more specifically, can wolves and cattle cohabit the public lands that connect the national parks of the American West, which is where wolves have been reintroduced? I guess there's really no conflict with respect to the national parks like Yellowstone, correct, Suzanne? I mean, those parks, great place to have wolves, natural part of the ecosystem. There's no conflict there, is there?
Well, there usually isn't, but, you know, there's elk populations that live within the national parks that migrate out. They do during the winter time, so mm-hmm. that's when we see, you know, some of our conflicts really start to spike that in the early spring.
Okay.
And there's people, you know, admittedly on both sides, very vocal people who want to see either all the livestock off of public lands or who want all the wolves off of public lands.
Right.
They want to have it for the livestock, and I think that it really takes people in the middle who are willing to work together, resolve these conflicts, and move forward. And I
are you able to work with that Jay Bodner, who's on the other line?
Yeah, he's a pretty good guy. we were on the same committee together over in Montana for the Montana Wolf Management Plan, and I think that plan itself, the stakeholder involvement that was involved in creating that plan, could really serve as a model for folks in Idaho and for folks in Wyoming for certain.
Well, now, this is really interesting. So what happened, evidently, is that wolves were at one time hunted to extinction. They were successfully reintroduced as an endangered species and protected as an endangered species. Then, relatively recently, they were delisted from the endangered species list, and the management of them was turned over to individual states. Am I correct in that reading?
You are.
Okay, now the individual states work differently with respect to how they're going to manage the wolves, and perhaps the state of Wyoming is one of the more aggressive states in manage it. They just turned it over to hunters. Did I read that as right as well?
Yeah, it wasn't even hunters. In Wyoming, wolves in 88% of the state lost all legal protection. So they went from being an endangered species one day, and the next day were just all protection off, and wolves were being killed on site. In fact, we had one man that claimed that he chased a wolf over 70 miles on snowmobile and then shot the animal when it became exhausted.
70 miles?
70 miles. He even admitted to trashing an $8,000 snowmobile. And so we lost all of the wolf population that we know of in southwestern Montana just within days or weeks after that delisting rule took place last March. So it was just too extreme. And Idaho also had the same kind of plan in mind where they, not quite as aggressive as Wyoming, but Idaho was going to kill half its wolf population before the end of this year through their hunting scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we really need to follow the example, I think, of Montana, where it's been more of a stakeholder involvement that we have.
Well, let's ask Jay.
Both sides.
Jay, yeah. How did you get along with these defenders of the wildlife as cattlemen?
Well, actually, Suzanne, as she mentioned, we've worked on a couple of different projects together. When it came to delisting, I think we were probably on the opposite ends of the spectrum when it came to that. Certainly, from livestock producer, what was originally has set forth in recovery goals in numbers and breeding packs, you know, we had far exceeded those numbers within the tri-state area.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fish and Wildlife Service had approved plans in Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho, and so basically, we thought we've met all the requirements. Now it's time to, you know, I guess consider this a success and move on and allow the state. We still had the Fish and Wildlife Service that was going to keep an eye on the state for at least 5 years. And if they were not to meet their management goals in all three states, then basically the wolves would be relisted again under the Endangered Species Act. So definitely we knew that there was going to be some take when it came to wolves, but I guess there was some argument about whether we have too many or too few. And
So a federal judge ordered them to be relisted again, and now that's the status of them, is that they are again protected and can't be hunted, correct?
Right. The Fish and Wildlife Service withdrew their 2008 delisting rule, so they've actually taken it off the table now. And the thing that I think is the most difficult and probably the most frustrating for all of us involved is that the service kind of went through this political tug of war, and it became more about the politics than it did about the science. In fact, the service had rejected Wyoming's plan flat out, and the state of Wyoming had sued the service to try to make them accept their wolf management plan. The service refused to do so, and then this last year, and we really feel strongly through political manipulation, that the service turned around and approved the same plan that they rejected a few years ago.
So at the very bottom of this, there is politics.
Oh boy, it's at the top, in the middle, and the bottom.
Okay. And is there a way of resolving the politics? It seems to be, to me at least, and I confess to being stuck in the middle. You know, I loved the opportunity to see the wolves in the wild, and yet my heart goes out to those ranchers and farmers who must somehow, you know, accept these wild critters into their environment and learn how to live with them. But it seems to me like this is a developing into a conflict between city people and country people, whereas it seems like the city people are the ones who are really supporting defenders of the wildlife, and it's the country people who are on the side of the stock growers and their various associations, and this is seems to be where the politics are developing, and we'll pursue that when we get back from this quick break. Michael Olson here. This is The Food Chain. We are talking with Suzanne Stone from Defenders of the Wildlife and Jay Bodner from the Montana Stock Growers Association, and you. You're invited to pick up your phone. We have a few minutes left. If you'd like to make a question or offer a question or comment, 831-479-1080 or 800-624-2665. We will be right back with a call of the wild. Do stay tuned. Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about the wolves, the howling of the wolves, and whether we can learn how to get along with the wolves and whether the wolves can learn how to get along with us. Jay Bodner, Montana Stock Growers Association, do you ever get the feeling like it's you against the city folks, or am I just imagining this?
Well, you know, certainly there are some strong feelings, I think, when in more urban settings, but I think actually there are some folks that typically, if they take some time and learn a little bit about the issue, they'll probably fall a little bit more in the middle of kind of the discussion. Because when folks come out, let's say to Montana, and they look along the landscape, I mean, they really value what they see. They see a lot of open space. They see, you know, low numbers of people, and they value that. And I think if they learn a little bit about the dynamics of how these wildlife interact with livestock producers, and if they have an opportunity to put somebody out of business, and that suddenly is subdivided, and there's a bunch of houses up, well, they don't necessarily want to see that either. So I think for folks that really understand the entire picture, it probably falls, there are certainly a lot of folks that fall a little bit more in the middle.
Okay, let's go to the phones. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1980. I'm going to try putting, Jay on hold. Ben, are you there?
I am, yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Seems to me that one of the issues here that's never been mentioned while I've been listening to the show is that Americans eat just too much meat, and if we ate less meat than we do, there'd be a lot less of the kinds of issues that Jay and Susan have been discussing. I'm no angel myself, in the sense I'm not a vegetarian, but I eat way less meat than the average American does. And not only does all of our meat eating cause the kinds of problems that we've been hearing about on your show, but they're also, it's also related to climate change and carbon in the atmosphere. The worldwide meat industry is one of the major contributors to putting carbon
into the Earth's atmosphere. With respect to that, I guess if we were all eating soy burgers, then the mountains and the national parks would be free for the running of the wolves, and that would be that. And we wouldn't need to, we wouldn't need your services, Jay, if we all ate soy burgers.
Well, actually, I think when you look at the landscape, and actually when you look at demand nationwide and actually worldwide, meat consumption is moving up. I mean, there are folks not only in the United States, but you know, in other countries across the global landscape that are increasing meat. And I think there are certainly some questions about the impact of the livestock industry on carbon and a lot of the climate change issues that I think are really need to be debated a lot more than what we have time for today.
Right. Well, let me ask, we only have a moment or two, but let me ask you both, do you think we'll find a way that we can learn how to get along here? Jay?
Well, I think there's somewhere in the middle that we can. I think from the livestock industry, we certainly know that wolves are going to be on the landscape, and they're going to remain there. And we need to find that balance. And that's going to be, the livestock industry is probably going to have some financial impact. But in turn, we would expect some management level of wolves to be taken care of also.
And Suzanne, what do you think?
Oh, I agree. I think that if we have the opportunity for our stakeholders here, especially in the region, you know, more than half of our residents here in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming want to have wolves. And with that comes the responsibility of managing them.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Jay Bodner, Montana Stock Growers Association, Suzanne Stone, Defenders of the Wildlife, and all of you out there. If you didn't get a chance to log on your comments, do so at metrofarm.com. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.